Let freedom ring throughout the land. Let no one pay your soul for dollars dirty hands. Demand the truth, transparency. For we must be the masters of our destiny. Let freedom ring.
Welcome, you're listening to Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts, founder of Homeopathy World Community, Debbie Brook, and vaccine rights attorney, Alan Phillips. This is Thursday, May 30th, 2013, just after 1 p.m. Eastern Time, 12 noon, 11 Mountain, and 10 a.m. Pacific Times, and we're glad to have you with us today. The first half hour here, we'll be talking about some vaccine rights issues, vaccine exemptions and waivers, and legislative issues. This is Vaccine Rights Attorney Alan Phillips speaking to you from Asheville, North Carolina, and my wonderful co-host Debbie Brook will be joining us at the half-hour mark to talk about some of the latest vaccine news in the U.S. and around the world. I wanted to start today by reading from a letter that a person in an activist in Wisconsin, I believe, where they have a bill pending that would allow objections to the flu vaccine. There's efforts all around the country going in opposite directions on this issue. There are states with bills pending that, if the bills are passed, would mandate flu vaccines for healthcare workers. Hospitals all over the country are already doing this as a company policy matter, but they're trying to get further backing and support by getting state legislatures to pass laws mandating it. But there are activists working in the other direction. They want to get laws passed that prohibit hospitals from mandating flu vaccines for their healthcare workers. And the science certainly supports the right to choose, and some of the information I want to read from a letter here will spell some of that out for us a little bit. The state of Oregon already has a law that prohibits hospitals from mandating flu vaccines. As far as I know, that's the only state in the country that has such a law, while other states are trying to pass laws doing exactly the opposite, to mandate legally flu vaccines for healthcare workers. So this is a very controversial issue. And as we've talked about on recent shows, we even have some folks, medical researchers and medical doctors, speaking out right out of mainstream medicine, people who are not anti-vaccine in any sweeping or general sense, but are saying the flu vaccine doesn't make any sense, that the research that's been done supporting flu vaccines is of very poor quality. And this gets into a whole other topic and issue about medical politics and the politics of healthcare publishing, scientific publishing in the medical arena. There are some serious problems there. But let me reel myself back in before I get off on a tangent there. This is a letter. I'm not going to name the person who wrote the letter. I didn't ask for permission to do that, but it's somebody who supports the right to choose for healthcare workers to refuse flu vaccines, if that's their choice, without there being any repercussions to their employment from their employer. And I'm not going to read the whole letter. It's almost a two-page letter, but I wanted to underscore a couple of parts of this. One point that the writer makes is one that is a common criticism of flu vaccines generally, and that's that the flu viruses are constantly changing. The virus that is dominant one flu season may not be the same one that's dominant the next flu season. And when they make flu vaccines, they have to make them, begin the manufacturing process many months in advance. And so they have to guess what strain of the virus or strains are going to be the dominant strains, because they're, according to one professional researcher at least, if not several, there are over 200 viruses that cause flu-like symptoms. And flu vaccines contain at most materials to address maybe three or four different flu strains. And so it's sort of a just a real shot in the dark, pun intended, I guess, to try and address the flu with a vaccine anyway, just at all, just in general. But it's entirely possible that you get a shot for, if you get a flu shot, that and let's assume for the moment that the shot works, which is a whole separate question, but let's, for the sake of argument, say that the flu shot works. You get sick anyway because it didn't protect you from the particular strains that are circulating that particular flu season. So you could have a perfectly safe and effective flu vaccine, and it still might be just a complete waste of money because it doesn't address the currently circulating flu strains. But there's another comment here that was interesting. I'll read directly from the letter on this next paragraph. The writer says, based on Center for Disease Control's own documents, the flu vaccine fails in over 40% of vaccinated employees. With such a level of ineffectiveness, vaccination status is not a reliable indicator of immune status. Furthermore, the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System and National Vaccine Injury and Compensation Program have revealed irrefutably that flu vaccines cause permanent death. Permanent death is pretty permanent usually, permanent disability, and even death. So you got a vaccine that fails, according to the CDC's own documents, over 40% of the time, and yet the vaccine can injure or kill you. So just that alone is just a profound statement. I'm resisting the temptation to elaborate on some of these different points. For example, the study that says the flu vaccines are about 60% effective was actually a misrepresentation of data. The 60% figure was, first of all, rounded up, and second of all, talking about what's called a relative risk reduction. The actual risk reduction was about 1.5%, which is, for all practical purposes, negligible. In other words, the flu vaccines don't have any real or minimal, at most and best, effect by the published peer-reviewed medical research. So serious problems there. But even if we take the CDC's figure of around 60% effectiveness, I think it was a Lancet study that came up with that figure, it just doesn't justify risking permanent disability and death from the vaccine. In September of 2011, I'm reading from the next paragraph in this letter now, in September of 2011, OSHA. Now, OSHA is a federal agency. It's the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. Occupational Safety and Health Administration. This is a federal agency that deals specifically with workplace safety. And they stated, they made a position statement, put out a position statement in September 2011, that OSHA, quote, believes there is insufficient scientific evidence for the federal government to promote mandatory influenza vaccination programs that do not have an option for the HCP, meaning healthcare professionals, to decline for medical, religious, and or personal philosophical reasons. So the federal agency whose job it is to oversee workplace safety and health says there's not sufficient evidence for a flu vaccine program promoted by the government that doesn't include a reason to decline for basically any reason. And yet the government's agenda is aggressively pursuing in this mandatory flu vaccination of all healthcare workers, which is only, by the way, a preliminary step to pushing for all U.S. employees to get the flu vaccine and 249 other vaccines after that, because there's just this endless stream of vaccines being researched and developed for anything and everything you can think of, and a couple of hundred things you would never think of until somebody told you. Because there's this just wide open door. They have no liability for the death and disability caused by their products. The government pays them to develop these vaccines. The government purchases the vaccines. The government mandates the vaccines. It's the biggest scam on the planet. And even though there are a growing number of people stepping up and speaking out right out of mainstream medicine, saying this is wrong, this is not medically sound, the agenda goes forward. So the government is not even consistent with itself here. Here's OSHA saying there's no scientific justification for the policy, and yet other parts of the government, the CDC in particular, pushing the policy and the agenda forward. So there's a lot of inconsistency even within the government itself. Very well-written letter, this person, and I certainly wish the folks in Wisconsin luck in getting this bill passed that would allow people to refuse for medical, religious, or other reasons. Or it either allows the exemption or it prohibits the mandate. I'm not sure which, but functionally somewhat equivalent ideas there. Well, I wanted to spend some additional time today talking about some of the questions that people have sent me over time that talk about our rights and sort of general and or fundamental legal rights issues as it concerns vaccines and our choices and rights or lack of rights to say no to vaccines that are mandated. I think I've talked in the past where people have said, asked the question, should I pick a church and join a church to get the exemption that way? And the short answer to that is, it doesn't matter whether or not you belong to an organized religion or which one you belong to. If you do, and if you join a church for the purpose of getting an exemption, that actually can be a reason to reject your exemption. So I don't recommend people doing that. I mean, if you do it and nobody finds out that's what happened, maybe it works. But from my point of view, as an attorney, I want to minimize people's risks. A lot of things are not about this will work or this will not work. A lot of things are this raises or lowers your risk of being rejected. Sometimes it's a risk factor. And joining a church to get the exemption is a risk factor because there's legal precedent that says doing that means legally your exemption, religious exemption, is insincere, and that's sincerity is a requirement. So if it's insincere, they can reject you. Now, there are still some laws on the books in some states as it pertains to school exemptions that require membership in an organized religion, and all I can say about that is that those laws are unconstitutional. If they were challenged in court, the remaining laws, they would very, very likely be held by the court to be unconstitutional, and those laws could be stricken for being unconstitutional. Of course, over the short term, that could mean you have no religious exemption at all until you get the legislature to enact a proper constitutional one, and that has happened in at least three or four states in the past. So you have to be careful about challenging these laws in court. The better approach would be simply to bring that issue to the attention of state legislators and ask them to amend the law to fix it, so that you don't have a period of time where you don't have a religious exemption at all. But in the meantime, it's possible for people to exercise an exemption even if they don't meet that requirement, because that requirement is arguably unenforceable, the church membership aspect of it. But you might need an attorney to help you make that argument to convince local authorities, but there's sort of a practical thing there. Local authorities, if they are kind of hip to this issue and what's going on with it, they probably would rather let the occasional person slide through who doesn't strictly meet the law, the requirement of an organized religion, because it's, essentially it's an unconstitutional requirement, rather than say, well, just because other states have held this to be unconstitutional doesn't mean that it is here, which is technically true. Courts that overturn one of these kind of laws because it's unconstitutional, that becomes, in some cases, instances, those cases have become legal precedent, points of reference in the law, but legal precedent from another jurisdiction doesn't require your jurisdiction to do anything. So strictly speaking, even though these are arguably unconstitutional laws where they still exist, they're still enforceable law in the states where they exist. But the deal is that local officials, do they really want to make you go to court and challenge this, the end result of which could ultimately be that the law gets rewritten, which would encourage more people to get the exemption than the current law does. So strategically for the local authorities, they're better off letting someone who challenges that individually for themselves or their child, let them fall through the cracks, so to speak, and have the exemption than they are to stand their ground backing an unconstitutional law that could result in the law being changed and opening the door or potentially inviting more people to exercise the exemption. But every case, every one of these sort of situations is a case-by-case basis. It just has to play out however it plays out. There was another question where people had asked about if you've had vaccines in the past, can you still have a religious exemption? There are some people who think, oh, you've had past vaccines, therefore you can't exercise a current religious exemption. And the bottom line is past vaccines do not prevent the exercise of a current religious exemption. Because people's beliefs can change, or sometimes people get vaccinated or allow their kids to get vaccinated despite their religious objections because they're pressured into it or don't know they have a legal right, something like that. So if you have a valid explanation for why you have the belief today and are requesting the exemption today, even though you've had some past vaccines or your children have had some past vaccines, then you can still potentially exercise the right, because the exercising a religious exemption today only requires that today you meet the requirements. It doesn't require that you have that today you have met the requirements for all of your life up to this point. So if you have the sincerely held religious belief today, you can qualify for the exemption regardless of what your past history is. I had somebody ask me once, they said, I'd like to know if I have the right not to have my children vaccinated due to studies and research on the reactions to the vaccines. And this is a really important question, because a lot of people discover the vaccine issue by way of information that comes to their attention that suggests that the mainstream beliefs are wrong or flawed, that there really are serious problems with vaccines despite what the CDC tells us and what most doctors tell us. And the bottom line is, your rights are not spelled out in science. Your rights are spelled out in the law. So if you want to know what your exemption rights are, you have to go look at the law that applies to your particular exemption situation. So if you're talking about kids in school or yourself in college as an adult, you're going to be looking primarily at state law. If you're looking at employment, if you're a college student in a healthcare curriculum doing clinical studies in a local hospital or local healthcare facility, and they are the ones that are requiring vaccines, then you're looking at federal civil rights law. If you're in the military or connected with the military, you'll be looking at federal regulations. If you're a civilian contractor with the military, federal civil rights law. So, again, immigration, you'd be looking at immigration, federal immigration regulations. So it just depends on what arena it is. But you've got to look to the law to see what is required in terms of the vaccines and what your options are for an exemption. And in terms of how you approach the exemption, you've got to look at the law to see what the procedure is. Though there are some instances, such as employees dealing with employer-required vaccines or potentially state laws that, for example, some states have laws that mandate vaccines for healthcare workers. They're often in that arena, there's often not a specific procedure spelled out in the law, so you've got it's a little more complicated in terms of figuring out how to approach it. But nonetheless, the starting place is the law. Now, in a perfect world, true and accurate science would inform and to some degree dictate what the law is. But we have a very imperfect world in this regard, and with lots of politics. In fact, far more often than not, politics is what drives policy and law, not true science or true legal rights in many instances, especially in this arena with vaccines. So it's not enough to do your research and find out where the problems are, because I've never seen a law, and I doubt that there is one currently, that says you have the right to do research on vaccines and decide what is best for you or your children. Sadly, we should have that right, because the state and federal health agencies and state and federal legislatures have demonstrated that they're not capable of objectively reviewing the science and lack of science on this issue and putting in place policy and laws that reflect the true science and true lack of science, where that's the case, concerning the vaccine issue. So things are a mess, but there are potential solutions here, and we all need to become legislatively active in whatever way works for us. And one of the simplest and most effective ways that I know to do that in the vaccine issue is to join the National Vaccine Information Center's advocacy portal. They have a website for that. It's nvicadvocacy.org. NV as in Victor, IC advocacy.org. And that's a website that focuses specifically on vaccine legislative issues. They post pending bills. There's close to 100 bills pending in over 30 states right now. You can go there, you can join, and they will tell you who your representatives are and tell you when there is legislation pending in your state that requires action. So you can spend very little time on your part and yet be up to speed on what's going on legislatively and taking action when you need to be taking action. Now, the advocacy portal is a work in progress. They're trying to get directors for every state. I don't believe they are close to achieving that specific goal at this point. So if you can get involved with this organization and support their efforts in any way, you're helping yourself, and you can help them to help you and others. Now, people often ask from time to time, moving on to another issue here, people ask about homeschooling. Are there any hoops you have to jump through to avoid vaccinating as a homeschooler? And referring to, of course, homeschooling your children, your minor children. And the homeschool issue, there's not a one-size-fits-all answer in this arena, just as with many, many other issues pertaining to vaccines, especially where children are concerned. It's a state law, primarily a state law issue. The federal government does not have authority under the U.S. Constitution to mandate vaccines for state residents, and so the mandates and the exemptions are all in state law for state residents. And so the laws accordingly will vary from state to state. And so if you want to know exactly, I mean, the CDC makes recommendations. It's a federal agency. It can't mandate vaccines for anybody, but it can certainly make recommendations, and it does. And many states will enact into law whatever the CDC recommends or something close to that. But the mandates, the vaccines that are mandated and which ones and for what children or other people and what ages, is just going to vary from state to state. The exemption rights, the exemption options, the exemption procedures, it's going to vary from state to state. So if you homeschool, can you avoid vaccines? Sure. Do you still have to exercise an exemption in some proactive way? In some states you do, in some states you don't. It's my understanding, for example, that in West Virginia, if you homeschool, you bypass the whole issue, which is great for people in West Virginia who can afford to homeschool, because the only exemption option you have there is medical. And so that's a very narrow window, and many people who want to avoid vaccines don't have a medical basis for doing so. Well, homeschooling is not an option that everybody can do as a practical matter, but for those who can, it can be a way to get out of it. My understanding in West Virginia is that if you homeschool, that's the end of the story. However, in other states, that may not be the case. I've had clients here in North Carolina who homeschooled and reported to me that they still had to actively exercise a religious exemption in order to avoid vaccines. This makes sense from a public policy point of view, where the policy is informed by mainstream beliefs, and it has to do with the idea that states are concerned with all of the citizens in their geographic territory, and that doesn't necessarily and that would necessarily include concerns about kids, whether they're being homeschooled or not. Although, historically, the reason that public schools have had the issue the way they have with immunization is because that is a place where children are in close proximity to one another, and diseases, infectious diseases, could then presumably spread quickly throughout a local community or population. And so public schools is where it's most important. So it's really not nearly as critical from that point of view that homeschoolers be immunized if we assume that immunizations work and are safe and effective. But of course they're not. Well, the first half hour is sliding by very quickly here, much more quickly than I expected, which seems to always be the case here. You're listening to Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. I'm vaccine rights attorney Alan Phillips. Joining me in a very few minutes here, my co-host Debbie Bruck, founder of Homeopathy World Community. But we're going to take a break here for a few minutes first. We appreciate having you with us today. We'll be back on the other side. We've got lots more to talk about, so stay with us. Well, we are back. You're listening to Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. This is vaccine rights attorney Alan Phillips. And with me, I hope, my co-host, Debbie Bruck, founder of Homeopathy World Community. Debbie, good afternoon.
I am here. I've been listening. I appreciate the way you begin each show on Thursday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, and how you bring us the questions that people on the ground really are asking, real-life scenarios, concerns, and questions, and the kinds of answers that people are coming up against, what kind of solutions we might have. I know the show is basically about the law, about legal action, things that are happening in the legislatures, and also steps that people can take to become active legislatively. But I have a list of a whole bunch of other things that I think that we seem to be able to touch upon that overlap this issue. Of those is transparency, both politically and medically, the freedom of information, that we receive information, for instance, in labeling of our food and labeling of our vaccinations, that we find out exactly what are the ingredients in them, how they're made. Censorship in the social networking environment, this is kind of coming to the foreground now. Natural News had something about it with a young woman who was a march on Monsanto, and they took down her web page because her children were holding a sign that said, "Organic food is my medicine." And then we have, what are the limitations to our rights and how are they being limited today? We have a lot of an overlap with in the environment, food freedom, medical science, and the medical system. I want to, of course, the major thing we talk about is vaccinations, and so that means we talk about contagious disease and alternatives. What are the alternatives to having to take a vaccine? So those are just something that I quickly jotted down as points that kind of cover the umbrella of topics that we talk about each week.
Wow. I want to, one of the things that you said just really, all of that, of course, important, very important information, but the one thing that just jumped out at me is somebody being censored for having said food is my medicine.
Yeah, they. I was just listening on Natural News this morning. He did an interview with, I want to remember her name, Andrea LaLama or something is her name, and she's from Ecuador, but she is an American citizen, married to an American, has two children with autism, and because she is outspoken about GMO and how it has affected her children, they took down her website, which I think it's back reinstated again. But in other words, it kind of gives you an inside story about the hidden links or connections between some of the large social networks, for instance, Google, Facebook, and I'm sure there's others that are in cahoots with Monsanto and other big industry. You know, that's why when the little people are writing their posts, they kind of get hidden. They're not really seen. They're not seen by friends of friends of friends for some reason. Your posts on Facebook can easily become manipulated. And
There are a lot of interesting questions to that. Let's explore that for just a little bit, but don't let me get too far off because I know there's a lot of other things we wanted to touch on today. But there would be a tendency, I think, for a lot of people to say, hey, I have a First Amendment constitutional right, you know, to free speech. I should be able to say whatever I want to on my website. And I want to clarify for folks, because this is a point of confusion even for law students and probably even some attorneys, depending on, I don't mean that as a put down for attorneys, I can put them down for lots of other reasons instead, but, and I can do that because I am one. The Constitution, the federal Constitution as a starting place, exceptions everywhere in law, and that's what we'll get to in a moment, but as a starting place, the federal Constitution does not apply to private entities. It applies to the government. The Constitution is an instrument whose founding intention was to keep government out of things that it shouldn't be involved in. And so the government should not be able to tell you what you can or can't say unless what you're saying goes beyond a certain reasonable level where it's causing harm or risking imminent harm or something like that. You know, if everybody could literally say anything they wanted to in any situation, a lot of people would say harmful things, and they probably shouldn't be allowed to. So we've spent, you know, the entire history of our country and ongoing as we speak with a series of court cases exploring where are the proper boundaries, you know, where is the limit between what somebody can and can't say and in what situation and so forth. And so those are, in some cases, intriguing and complex questions. But my point here, though, is that a lot of people don't recognize that, again, as a starting place, the Constitution doesn't apply to private entities. So if Facebook is a private company, can they take down anything they want to? You know, can they decide what you can or can't say? Because that's not the government telling what you can or can't say.
When you sign in, you're just signing away your life, all of your personal information. They have it. They are data mining every single thing about you. And, yes, they have a right because it's a – they're not obligated to let you say anything you want. I think what they said was it was abusive. That was the determination why they took down that woman's headline.
Well, I think to a large extent, large corporations will try to put in policies that that factor in the idea that people have these broad ideas, even if sometimes mistaken, about what their rights are. In other words, people have expectations. And so the extent to which a private company wants people participating in whatever product or service they're offering and providing, they're going to, on a purely common sense level with regard to achieving their financial goals, they want to implement policies that will encourage and attract consumers. But, you know, are they necessarily required to honor your federal constitutional free speech rights, not if it's a private company. Now, the exception here, or an exception, there may be others, but the one I'm aware of off the top of my head is that when a private entity, person or company, usually we'd be talking about businesses here though, when a private business has what the law refers to as substantial ties to government, then that opens the door for the Constitution to apply directly to the private entity. As to what that phrase, substantial ties, means in practical real-world terms, well, we just have to look at legal precedent, federal and state court cases that have explored that question with regard to specific real conflicts that have come up and gone to court. So, and we'll try to explore that in any detail right now, but suffice it to say that you don't necessarily always have a free speech right or a First Amendment free exercise of religion right or other kinds of rights. It depends on the situation, who the plays are, what the circumstances are. So, at the end of the day, with a private company like Facebook, if you don't like their rules and their terms, you don't have to have a Facebook account. You know, it's not a requirement that anybody be on Facebook.
And, well, let me answer that. You know what? You're absolutely correct. You're not required to be on Facebook. It is a private corporation. They do set the rules and standards for their own website. And Natural News, Mike Adams, because of this, said, okay, we're out of there. Usually all of the comments on his website go directly to Facebook if you log in via Facebook. So, which is how it has always been. He's now disconnected from Facebook, and if you want to comment, you join Disqus, D-I-S-Q-U-S, which is someplace I've been on for about 4 years. So it is another place that will retain and organize all of your social networking activity and your commenting. And a lot of
so this is an alternative to Facebook?
This is an alternative to Facebook where you do not it wants you to sign in via Facebook there, but you don't have to. You have a choice. You can sign in via your email account and use Disqus to comment, to post a comment, and have a profile and an identity. So,
well,
it's sort of a state. It's a sort of a big statement, and if more people on more networks would say, okay, you don't have to comment, leave your comments on your WordPress or whatever kind of network platform you're using. You can comment using another service. That's less information going to Facebook.
Now, there is a practical reality here, though, because there's the argument of nobody's required to be on Facebook, that kind of argument is certainly legitimate and valid, but sometimes only up to a point. You know, I'm going to use a different example here to underscore the concept here, is that, you know, nobody's legally required to have an email address or to have a cell phone. But the practical reality is, at this point in time, most people do. And so there's an expectation in our society that everybody has an email address and that everybody has a cell phone. And, you know, you sign up for things, especially online, and they will ask you for your cell phone, you know, and if you are among the now very small percentage of people that don't have a cell phone, you might be out of luck. Maybe you can't even sign up for something. I've encountered that on the internet before. Like, I didn't have a cell phone, or my cell phone, I do have one, but I use it rarely and sparingly. It's not a regular communication tool for me, so I don't give that number out, because if people try to call me, they're not going to get me. I use it when I'm traveling, and that's just about it. So keeps the cost down, and it keeps my exposure to cell phone radiation down. And I tell you, after information that I have read just in the last couple of days and updated my personal awareness on cell phone and other kinds of electromagnetic radiation that we're exposed to.
I only use speaker function on cell phone.
We have on the chat
in freedomizerradio.com, LiveFeedUSA is telling us that Skype is another place that you want to keep your security, and there is another option to Skype for that talking is raketu.com. I don't know that, you know, I use Skype to log into all of my Blog Talk Radio shows. We don't have the option to do that using raketu.com. But maybe on your personal communications, you would want to sign into that other option for communicating. We use it for telephoning internationally or locally. So do you want to get into some more news regarding vaccines? I've got a big one for you.
Go for it.
GSK buys the Swiss vaccine developer for $324 million. It's right here in the RTP, Research Triangle Park in North Carolina. GlaxoSmithKline acquired Acaris AG, Swiss developer of vaccine technologies, for $324 million, will expand their operations and inoculations. It's an all-cash purchase. I wonder why they have to tell us that. They are at early stage.
I just want to know how much cash they have lying around.
Targeting respiratory syncytial, whatever that is, virus, hepatitis C, malaria, TB, Ebola, HIV. The London-based Glaxo, okay, good to know. London-based Glaxo is doing experimental vaccines for malaria and hepatitis C. They're in the second of three stages of testing. So you can check that out. What does it all mean that they're buying out another vaccine developer?
Well, it's part of a broader movement I see in the healthcare arena of consolidation, for one thing, and that probably is happening in and out of the healthcare arena. But it also is, I think, directly a byproduct of the wide open door that I keep increasingly referring to, in that, you know, government subsidizes vaccine development, mandates the vaccines, buys vaccines, and government cleans up the mess that the vaccines leave, in the sense that government pays for the injury and death whenever you are an injured person or family of a person killed by a vaccine is lucky enough to get through the system and get any compensation at all. Because about three quarters of the people who seek compensation never see a dime. But
here's
government
a little
does
bit
all
more
of that.
Information.
Why wouldn't?
Go ahead.
Well, I mean, that's the door is wide open. So anybody and everybody, you know, who has no moral or ethical missing that part of their brain that processes moral and ethical concerns and considerations is running as fast and hard as they can to get to and through that door. But anyway, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you know, we have just participated in March on Monsanto because we don't want GMO genetic engineering. So the company Okairos, OKAIROS, which they just purchased, uses viruses to deliver genetic material into cells, stimulating the immune system. Its technology has been tested in more than 700 people. And Glaxo, in the UK's biggest drug maker, said it plans to use the technology from closely held Acaris to produce vaccines that prevent infection and fight disease such as cancer. So they want to use genetic engineering and put them into our cells. We're just going to turn into something we don't recognize anymore. Glaxo already sells vaccines, including influenza, hepatitis, rotavirus, and is developing the ones for malaria. They generate 3.3 billion pounds. That's $5 billion in revenue just last year alone. And you can read more about that online, and probably will hear more about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a multi-billion dollar industry that's projected to grow at a rate of about 12% over the next several years. Last report I read on that, at least through 2017. So again, is just,
you might hear some people, you know, there are some people who say, gee, American corporations haven't been very successful lately. They don't produce very much, and when they do, we have to applaud them. But now I realize that GlaxoSmithKline is in London. It's not an American company, right?
Well, based in London, but they probably have divisions all over the planet, and I'm sure here in the U.S. I don't have specific information on that.
I guess just wondering whether they're part of our tax revenue.
Well, they're certainly selling vaccines to a number of different countries, and I'm again, I don't have specific information, but I would be shocked if someone were to say, oh, no, they don't sell any vaccines to the U.S., as I'm sure they do, probably do. But
did you already read about Leslie Manoukian, and she wrote an article about HPV vaccine is not the right solution?
No, please tell us about it.
Oh, that was posted in the Idaho Express, and there's a health column, and she says, questions, why worry about HPV? It was posted May 3rd, 2013, and, you know, they are promoting more and more the Gardasil vaccine. They're using the campaign, the advertising campaign, Be One Less, and I think, you know, Be One Less who contracts a disease, but Be One Less might not be what they mean. What is actually what will happen, because so many young girls have been affected by this virus, the vaccine, not the virus. Merck's human papillomavirus, HPV, is Gardasil. They received an advertising award for market out of thin air. The virus that infects most within a few years of becoming sexually active, 90% of the women infected with HPV will clear the virus on their own within 2 years of infection. That's kind of important to allow the body to heal itself and not be living out of fear all the time. Of the 10% that don't clear the infection, it takes another 3 years to 5% to progress to precancerous lesions, and another 5 years to progress further to invasive cancer, meaning that there's 10 years that you have steps that you can take to improve your lifestyle, improve the way that you take care of yourself, and hopefully remove any potential for cancer. So also the other thing is annual pap smears have been used for many decades, and they don't have any side effects. Why are these not being promoted more as opposed to trying to give people a vaccine? She questions all of that. They actually carry zero risk to the recipient. There have been 23,000 adverse reactions reported about the vaccine adverse events reporting system, theirs, including 10,000 emergency room visits and 85 deaths in the United States alone from the HPV vaccine. These just are a couple of tidbits that you will read on that story.
Yeah, I wonder what and there's everything you've said so far, I think, assumes that the vaccine presumes, or at least doesn't refute the idea that the vaccine might be effective. And that's, of course, a whole separate question with any vaccine, but this one in particular, because the only way you would really know to have any concrete, tangible evidence would be to do the 30 or 40 year study where you see what is the cancer rate of people in their 40s, 50s, and 60s who got the vaccine when they were teenagers or in past decades, earlier, younger decades. And so it's really a long-term project. We don't have any of that kind of data. It's not, the vaccine hasn't been around long enough. And so it's, in that respect, any claim that of its effectiveness is speculative. It's not possible to have data, direct definitive data on that yet. So all the more reason.
They typically don't even do enough trials. I think she said that they've only studied fewer than 1,200 girls under the age of 16, and they're asking everyone, every boy and girl from age 9 to 26 to get this vaccine. It doesn't jive. It doesn't click that what they are requesting people to do makes no sense in terms of the amount of testing for safety and for efficacy, really.
Well, and therein lies...
cancer is, go ahead.
And therein lies the fundamental issue with vaccines, is that the policy is not driven by science. It's driven by something else. Now, you don't have to go any farther than what I call the follow the money syndrome to see that there are serious problems with the policy and law, that it's clearly designed to enhance and increase substantially pharmaceutical profits at a time when many major patents, which are high earners for pharmaceutical companies, are on the verge of running out in terms of those time limitations. And so they're looking for other ways to keep revenue coming in, and vaccines, because of the open door I keep referring to, is very, very attractive. And so they're going down this route. But the way you maximize your profit with a vaccine, for example, is not to make the most scientifically valid, safest, most effective vaccine and have that delivered in the most appropriate and effective way, appropriate in a medical scientific sense, medical way to those people who need it. The way you make the most money with a vaccine is to make sure that you have minimal development costs and maximum distribution. And it's really that simple. And the way you get maximum distribution is that you create what I think most of the time in reality is the illusion of a need for the vaccine.
Right, so it's marketing.
Marketing. And if you have difficulty creating that mentality, then you just go to the legislature and have them mandate it, and then you bypass the whole marketing thing altogether.
Oh, God.
It's probably a lot less expensive to lobby the legislature than it is to brainwash the masses, although it's ultimately some combination of the two that has led to the current vaccine policy and legal landscape we have with vaccines. So, these are the issues
so
that are going
radical.
On. But when it doesn't make sense medically, you have to go outside of the medical considerations to understand what's going on. And again, this is the fundamental issue with this whole vaccine issue. Debbie, I'm going to jump in here and cut you off. We actually have eaten through another half an hour here so much more quickly than
thing here?
Sure, and then we'll go to break and we'll be back.
Okay, I'm going to give you another tasty tidbit since we started off talking about genetic engineering and putting genetic information into your cells. Obama has given the okay for Pepsi to put fetal cell tissues into the Pepsi Cola that we drink because it adds some flavor. And
flavor?
It adds, it's flavor enhancing aborted fetus cells. There you go.
It seems so obvious. I don't know why I didn't think of it.
We're eating ourselves. We're cannibals. That's how I think of it.
It is. I can't think of a word that really covers this one. My tasteless humor a couple of moments ago, I'm sure, was just some attempt on me on a deep psychological level to somehow wrestle with this without just totally freaking out. Well, I'll give myself another couple of minutes here to try and process that, and maybe we'll come back and talk about that on the other side of break. You're listening to Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. with vaccine rights attorney Alan Phillips and Homeopathy World Community founder Debbie Brook. We're going to go to break for a little bit here, but we will be back. We've got another hour to go on the show today, folks, so do stay with us. We are back. You are listening to Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. with vaccine rights attorney Alan Phillips and Homeopathy World Community founder Debbie Brook. Debbie, where did we leave
off?
Hi.
I just wanted to say, basically there are people up at the top pulling the strings. They're saying who is wise enough, smart enough, or powerful enough, or influential enough to be able to be a participant in the decision-making process. Do we as consumers have the right to purchase something based on knowledge about the ingredients that are there because they have been properly labeled? And in the same way, the shareholders at PepsiCo were kind of upset about the corporate policy to enable the use of these fetal cells. It's human embryonic kidney, HEK-293, to produce flavor enhancers for their beverages. And basically they responded that the stockholders are too stupid to understand what they are doing with the remains of aborted children, meaning that, you know, people who are in power are making decisions alone, on their own. What do you want to give them power? what is the proper words for that? But they're not taking into consideration the voices of many other people.
Well, and the bottom line is it's because they don't have to. And this is part of the problem. I think to some extent it's human nature that when people are in positions of power, I remember hearing a story anecdotally through a relative of mine knew a woman who worked for an attorney, and she talked about when the attorney's son, adult son, graduated law school and joined the firm. And the report was, it takes them about a year to figure out how everything really works. And it's like, oh, you mean all I have to do is this and I get paid that much? And
yeah.
I'm using that as sort of a specific for example of an abstract concept that I'm going at here. There's just something about power. You know, the old adage that absolute power corrupts absolutely. Well, that's only part of the story. Less than absolute power corrupts correspondingly. Maybe not absolutely, but there's just power is highly addictive. And when people experience it, at least some of them want more. And there's this real arrogance that is prevalent, not with everybody, but with many people who are in positions of power. You know, the classic example that we talk about from time to time on this show is just that medical doctors. I joked about this in an article I just published with Natural News about how doctors suffer from, I was actually picking on in particular Dr. Paul Offit, who's a staunch pro-vaccine advocate, and how he suffers from ego encephalitis, which is inflammation of the part of the brain that has to do with the ego. And this idea, of course, all in tongue-in-cheek and jest here, but that how doctors tend to regard themselves as experts in everything because they have a medical degree. And there's just this arrogance, which with many individuals goes well beyond arrogance to level of hubris, prevalent in the medical
community. Well, let's not generalize. Let's not generalize.
No,
you know,
as long as we say we're generalizing, I think it's okay to generalize because I experienced this myself with, you know, the majority of medical doctors that I've ever interacted with. There's this mentality of, shut up, I'm God, you do what I say, you do it my way, or, you know, you're a terrible, awful person. There's just not room for discussion, and it's not based on information. It's based on some deeply rooted insecurity connected with their surface conscious belief that they're better than everybody else.
Can I move this discussion a little bit more toward, I don't know how it fits into the legality, but proprietary information. A lot of times a person is simply cut off and dismissed, put out of any conversation because a company, like a corporate company, has proprietary information and you cannot dare go step over the line to inquire about it. And it's sort of like Coca-Cola's formula or PepsiCo's ingredients, these kinds of things. How do we know what we're actually being fed or injected with?
Well, we only know to the extent that law requires them to tell us, and otherwise, whatever they choose to reveal. Let me just real quickly complete the other thought, though, Debbie, because I'm fine with not getting stuck on that point, but I did want to finish the thought. My point is that people in positions of power are subject, as I think all human beings potentially are, to the inebriation of the power and
okay.
to being addicted to the power, and then to the use, misuse, and abuse of the power that comes from the unhealthy relationship with power for those that have ultimately an unhealthy relationship. And this is something that I think increases in frequency and severity as the degree of power increases. And these are generalizations. There are absolutely wonderful people trying to do, and in some cases probably actually doing great things in state and federal legislatures, in the medical community, in the legal communities, and so forth. But there are many people who, I believe, in my experience and observations, succumb to the addiction or inebriation aspect of power, and that skews their perception of their responsibilities and functions with whatever their particular power management situation is. So I'm not saying that to single out medical doctors or any other group. I think I'm an attorney. I see it in the practice of law. I see it with attorneys and judges. I see it in many places. But it appears to me to have a correlation, at least generally, with power and control. And I think all human beings are susceptible to one degree or another to the problems associated with power. And it's like greed.
That's why
is,
we have a checks. Supposedly have a constitution and a government based on checks and balances.
But what we have is an erosion of those checks and balances by those who have an interest in bypassing the check and balance. And so that's a very serious problem. When you've got industry dictating policy and law to industry's benefit, and that's exactly what's going on with vaccines, that is not a proper check and balance. There should be, as Robert Scott Bell put it, and I don't know if I'm quoting him exactly or not, so I apologize, Robert, if I'm missing the quote, but the concept will be the same. Separation of vaccine and state, or separation of pharmaceutical industry and state. However he said it was quite eloquent, and I'm not being eloquent in my attempt, probably failed attempts, but the concept there is important. There should be clear, hard lines between industry and government, and what we have is exactly the opposite, these unhealthy, incestuous relationships where the government caters to industry rather than ignoring industry and catering to constituents as it is supposed to do and as its representatives claim to do, regardless of what's actually going on.
Okay.
Anyway,
well,
thanks for letting me
get
that out.
It's up to us to participate in our government and to participate in our defending our rights.
Our ability to participate is severely limited. For example, the recent Supreme Court ruling that businesses are persons and they can spend whatever they want to in campaigns, that means that we as individuals are virtually ineffective have been rendered ineffective in our capacity or ability to participate in government. Nobody should be able to be a representative for more than one or at most two consecutive terms, because what develops out of that is all this political game playing and not people who are really there doing the business of the people as they're supposed to do. There are serious problems, but those who benefit from a corrupt system have taken steps to ensure that their benefits are maintained or expanded on. So we have our work cut out for us. Yes, we need to participate in the system. It is still one that we can participate in, but the deck has been stacked against us substantially by the system itself and by those who have managed to successfully manipulate the system to create disadvantages for in many instances, for truth, for individuals, for personal freedoms, and limiting our ability and capacity to interfere with their use, manipulation and control of government to their own ends. So it's the system has not been rendered completely impotent at this point, but it's definitely evolving, has been and continues to evolve in a way that moves away from the original intentions and spirit of law, the way this country was founded. You know, the founding fathers, and I don't remember the specific one, so I'll just refer to them generally, although there was a quote from one in particular, probably Benjamin Franklin, but basically saying something to the effect of, you know, good luck with your new republic if you can hold on to it. And it's slipping away, frankly, right now, as we're watching our rights being eroded by the legislatures and the courts both, in what to me appears to be, in many instances, the effects of politics and, in particular, corporate control of government to its own benefits and ends. But let me reel myself in, Debbie, and let's get back to some of the specifics here. This is a real quick one. There's an article here that talks about a vaccine to prevent relapse for heroin addiction. It's an interesting concept, and they say that the vaccine, they say that it's been successful with mice, because we all know how terribly addicted mice can be to heroin, but no, of course, they will create heroin-addicted mice to test the vaccine on. They say it does not target opioid receptors, and so that it could be used in conjunction with other treatments. Because my concern about the idea of giving someone a vaccination for heroin addiction, let's assume that the vaccine works. It binds, it basically prevents the person from getting the benefit of heroin. I don't know if I can find the exact language here, and I don't want to turn it into a medical discussion, but it's what they call a dynamic vaccine that creates antibodies against heroin. And it's just sort of interesting, but basically it's going to prevent the heroin from getting the person high, bottom line. Well, let's assume just for the sake of discussion that it's a safe and effective vaccine, that it does what it purports to do, it doesn't have any side effects, and so everybody who's a heroin addict who wants to get rid of the addiction might consider this, or maybe even somebody might consider it who wants to avoid becoming addicted in the first place. If someone is addicted and they're not getting the high from the vaccine, because I could envision hypothetically a future situation where judges would be ordering that someone get this vaccine, because they're an addict and they've been robbing or stealing from people to support their addiction or something like that. If someone is addicted and they're not up for getting rid of that addiction, then the withdrawal, even if you are up for it with heroin in particular, very, very strong, strongly addictive substance, the withdrawal is a potential real nightmare. And if somebody's not up for that or doesn't have proper support to get through that, I could see a vaccine like this having really serious negative consequences. But in any case, it's an interesting concept and just a really good example of the scope, the idea that the scope of vaccines and that are in research and development is just goes far beyond any original ideas about vaccines for infectious disease. So just wanted to put that out there and let folks know what's going on.
Okay. Did you want to talk about anything else? Specifically, there's the vitamin C for tuberculosis. This is a groundbreaking news study showing that vitamin C can kill drug-resistant tuberculosis. So what say we take some more vitamin C instead of getting a TB test or putting that into our vaccines? Is that an idea?
Well, I love hearing about this, Debbie, because it's seems like such a simple answer to what's been a perplexing and complex problem, not only with tuberculosis specifically, but other diseases where that the consequence of extensive use of antibiotics is that we have been unwittingly creating antibiotic-resistant strains of the very diseases we're trying to use antibiotics to cure. And, boy, there's so many problems with this, and as a homeopath, Debbie, I know you can appreciate some of this probably far better than I can, but I love the, and this is my basic concept, and please feel free to correct or clarify or add to this, but my understanding is a general concept, you know, antibiotics is an intervention style of approach to an infectious disease. It may be very effective and necessary or useful in some situations. I'm not suggesting anything to the contrary, but when you intervene, when you interfere with the body's own natural reaction, you cut short the body's ability to handle the problem and develop and mature and strengthen its immune system in the process. For example, I've heard research that says when you treat ear infections that are treated with antibiotics, and by the way, the difference in treating an ear infection with antibiotics and not is that if you treat it with antibiotics, I think it takes about a week to clear up. If you don't, it'll take as many as 7 days. So there's a huge difference there. But in any event, that there was research showing that when they use antibiotics to treat ear infections, there was a significantly greater recurrence rate than if you treated it homeopathically or let it heal on its own. Now, there may be severe ear infections, you know, where maybe somebody is justified in interjecting antibiotics, but just as a routine knee-jerk reflex that ear infection prescribe antibiotics, that's probably not a smart thing to do. So not only are you interfering with the body's own ability to heal itself and strengthen itself and move past the susceptibility to the ear infection in the first place, you're potentially creating antibiotic-resistant strains which are more resistant to treatment measures or more serious disease cases in the first place. So that we could potentially bypass all that with TB in this particular example with a whole different kind of therapy altogether is just a wonderful idea to me.
If it's possible, that's correct. There, the report says that the use of vitamin C fell out of favor when antibiotics did come into use. And this was done all at Albert Einstein College of Medicine of Yeshiva University. The vitamin C kills drug-resistant TB bacteria. Let's see what else it says. It was originally reported in Nature Communications, and without the drug, an estimated 650,000 people worldwide have multi-drug-resistant TB. So it showed its effectiveness in the lab, and they want to test it in the real world. So maybe we need to see how it actually works in the real world, how much vitamin C and what kind of vitamin C, and whether there is some synergy with other kinds of activities, whether it's exercise, sunlight, rest, or fluids, or other vitamins that might work synergistically with it. It has also had a track record working with fighting diseases such as the measles and whooping cough. So it has potential. I mean, Linus Pauling has been talking about it for so long, right? And
decades.
Let's see, decades. 3,000 to 5,000 milligrams a day. That's a lot. It was used. Okay, that's how much it is recommended by Dr. Brownstein. So that's one of the things that's going on. The other...
Well, let me pause right there just a little bit, because I wanted just to add a couple other comments. I know there's been research in the past looking at vitamin C as treatment for polio. It's been shown effective. And in some instances, and I don't remember if this was a polio research and or other research with vitamin C, but in some cases they were doing really high doses intravenously. And so it's not necessarily something you do just by chewing on vitamin C tablets you get at the drugstore or the grocery store. But there's been a lot of research, and I, from a cynical point of view, admittedly, you know, you talk about how antibody, vitamin C and other approaches fell out of favor as antibiotics came in. Is that because antibiotics were more effective, or is that because antibiotics were more lucrative? You know, you know, if we really want to find out the effectiveness of vitamin C in treating, well, any condition, we need to find a way that we can allow the pharmaceutical company to own vitamin C and sell it to us at exorbitant prices, and then we find out really how effective it is. And I'm being a little sarcastic there, but I think there's a serious point
that would work.
The sarcasm. You know, I'm not suggesting that we promote reinforce the current dysfunctional system, but it is somewhat disturbing that we see the current policy and law being driven, if not also by other agendas, certainly by a financial one.
Uh-huh.
That's the wrong thing to drive
health care. I think it would really work. So
sadly, it probably would. Not a good strategy, you know, for civilized human beings, but the practical reality is it might actually work. But please go on, Debbie. I know you had something else. I want to mention one other thing before we go to break here, too. But
go ahead. Do it.
Oh, okay. Well, I just wanted to just a brief announcement here. I've been working on trying to revise my ebook, The Authoritative Guide to Vaccine Legal Exemptions. I had originally hoped to revise it annually, and I did that for the first couple of years. The first version was out in 2007. I'm embarrassed at how long it's been, although the biggest upgrade was the last one, the next to last one. I just finished another revision, long story short here, and the ebook has been updated. I've got really critical new information. I've learned a lot, for example, in the employee healthcare arena in the last couple of years, and other areas where not only is law continually evolving or changing, but my experience with vaccine exemptions and waivers is constantly growing. And so the ebook is now available. I keep hearing that it's available at freedomizerradio.com. If it is, I think that's a great place for people to go to get it. Debbie, I think you offer it also on Homeopathy World Community, terrific place. Because if people purchase the ebook through either of those sources, then half the proceeds go to those organizations. And Debbie, you and I and the folks at Freedomizer Radio are all putting in tremendous amounts of volunteer time trying to educate people about how the world really works and what people can do about the problems with vaccines and other areas. And so this is a great way to help all of us. And to help yourself, because there's just no other document out there anywhere that has this level of detail, that's reliable information coming from an attorney with 10 years of experience working with vaccine exemptions and waivers in over a dozen different categories and subcategories. And so this is the definitive publication for understanding how the law works, and in particular with regard to vaccine exemptions and waivers. So it's available at homeopathyworldcommunity.com, freedomizerradio.com, and, of course, on my own website, vaccinerights.com. And just want to let people know that it's out there. And, Debbie, tell us whatever you'd like to throw in here while we're on the vaccines and your rights in the U.S. portion of the show. We'll go to break,
okay. And
are we coming back today with you and homeopathy?
Yeah, I think I'll just chat away about the I'm going to talk,
okay.
You know, my main thing is about stress reduction. I might give you a little stress. I'm going to talk about metals and the environment. Here's the question. Here's the topic to take us out. Have we already discussed fear of vaccinations linked to weak knowledge? This poll that says it's, you know, the fact that people who have poor general knowledge about science are more likely to be fearful of getting vaccinations for themselves or their children?
Yeah,
have we discussed
that's exactly
that?
The opposite of what I've been hearing, because the people who exercise exemptions tend to come from the more highly educated arenas in the population. So I believe that's just more propaganda. It's interesting. I mean, it's you know, it's scary in some ways too, Debbie, but it's interesting that we see the step up of propaganda, also techniques. You know, they're developing apps now so that doctors can report where and why people are opposing exemptions and supposedly not sharing the actual personal data, although who knows ultimately what is and isn't being shared. But there are increasingly sophisticated strategies that are being employed to promote the pharmaceutical agenda, and vaccine propaganda being a big part of that. So social networking is being scoured to see who is saying what about vaccines and where are the concentrations, if any, of exemptions or growing exemption rates or vaccine refusal. They're becoming more and more sophisticated in their ways of identifying and tracking us and responding to that with more propaganda promoting the vaccine agenda. And all I have to say about that is, while it's scary, in one sense, and I say this cautiously, it's a positive sign, because they wouldn't be feeling the need to resort to those tactics if we weren't being successful with our agenda of mm-hmm. raising awareness and promoting and supporting freedom of choice and access to complete information. So at the end of the day, what's going to prevail is the more reasonable approach, and the idea that people should be free of corrupt influence, be able to, and the only way you can do that is to make your own informed choice. You cannot be free of corruption just to do what I say. If I'm saying don't listen to them, listen to me, that's not the answer. The answer has to be, and has to include, access to complete information and the right to make your own informed decision, because anytime somebody can make the decision for you, there's room for bias, manipulation, control, influence, even if it's unintended, your ability.
It's almost as if the one of the things I'll mention here about this poll or this survey, it comes from a company called Welcome Trust. So take it from there. Welcome Trust says something to me, and something that I would not trust. Who are they doing the survey for? And also, I feel as if it's an attack on people's character, people's how they feel about themselves, an attack on their belief system and on their doubts and on their insecurities, to tell people that you are stupid, you are dumb, and therefore that's why you have this fear of getting the vaccination, rather than, you know, it's actually the most educated people, which is true. We've previously seen surveys to the effect that it's the most educated section of American society that has the trend not to vaccinate. So they're butting up against that information with this made-up survey, you know, whoever what. So you have to always put on your critical thinking cap and find out who is saying that. I'm sure we probably need a break.
So we're back, and I'm going to turn it all over to you, Debbie. Thank you so much for your engaging conversation today, as always, and I'm looking forward to hearing the rest of the show with you today.
Thank you. So I'm going to talk about cadmium in the news, and because it seems to be pretty high in activity right now, because China had a problem where they announced over the weekend that the government inspectors discovered 44.4% of rice and rice products tested this year in the southern city of Guizhou, I don't know how to pronounce it, Gansu in Guangdong province, showed high levels of cadmium. And they have had considerable amount of problems with a number of their food products, hoof and mouth disease in their pigs, and therefore today there was an announcement that they have just bought the Smithfield plant here in North Carolina, another country that's buying another American factory to produce pigs and pork. And it's kind of frightening about what's going to happen to these animals and who are going, these animals will be sold to. Specifically, they're trying to get cleaner animals to sell to the Chinese people, but who knows where it will end up or what will happen to them. They're trying to get it to pass through the FDA so that instead of importing their own products here to America. It's kind of complicated and political, and you can make your own conclusions. But the issue about arsenic in our rice and cadmium in our rice and other heavy metals and the heavy metals in our vaccines are of concern, since we know absolutely 100% scientifically that it can cause havoc in living organisms and humans specifically. We can find aluminum, arsenic, cadmium, lead, mercury, and nickel as heavy metals that can cause neurological damage and other kinds of illnesses and disease. I'll give you a little bit more information about that in just a moment. These are carcinogenic medicals that can seriously damage the kidneys as well as cause cancer, breast cancer. One of the worst scandals, at least 6 babies died and 300,000 became sick in 2008 after being fed milk powder tainted with the industrial chemical melamine. That was also in China. So we know, keep your eyes open for what's happening in China. The high cadmium levels may raise the risk for dying from liver disease, says a study. People with high levels of cadmium in their urine are much more likely to die of liver disease than those with lower levels. Should we all get our urine tested for this heavy metal? I'm not sure whether that is an answer. It can also be found in industrial pollution and tobacco smoke. So just giving you an idea where these metals may be found in the environment through environmental pollution and the pollution of some of our foods. There was a study where researchers analyzed data from more than 12,700 people who took part in the United States National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey. People with the highest levels of cadmium in their urine were nearly 3.5 times more likely to die of liver disease. I'm going to move on to another article that says, cadmium consumption may lead to breast cancer. The next time you're eating, or you might want to skip the cadmium-heavy foods. And what are cadmium-heavy foods? We're going to have to find out what those are. It's a toxic metal found in the environment, which I just mentioned. Women who consumed a lot of this dietary cadmium had 21% higher chance of developing breast cancer. I think that sounds like a way higher chance of getting breast cancer than the BRC gene, but I don't think that people should be removing their body parts just because of this. It can be found in burning fossil fuels, according to the EPA. Costume jewelry has been found to high levels of toxins and carcinogens. Because of the high accumulation in agricultural crops, the main sources of dietary cadmium are, get this, bread and other cereals, potatoes, root crops, and vegetables. I think we better really head off to the organic and local gardeners, don't you think? The study observed 56,000 people for over 12 years. Participants were asked to estimate their dietary cadmium exposure through food frequency. It makes me want to question whether I'm going to eat my root crops. As much as I love my beets and rutabagas and other things, you know, how can we have our food tested? During follow-up, researchers found that 2,112 women developed breast cancer, including 1,626 estrogen receptor positive cases, which means estrogen made the cancers grow. It's a little bit more involved with the study. And cadmium is a soft white silver metal, and it has similar estrogen-like qualities, which, you know, this is one of the things of our environment. When we have hormone-mimicking agents like BPSA, bisphosphonyl A in our can linings, and other things that we're eating, we have to really take care of what we put in our mouth and what we feed our children. This carcinogen, after repeated exposure to the metal, was linked to lung as well as kidney disease. So has anyone been reading about cadmium? Is it at the top of your list of things to be concerned about? So what else do I want to tell you? I want to tell you that cadmium affects the body's enzyme activity, and one of the early signs of toxicity is high blood pressure. It is found in water and foods such as oysters, instant coffee and tea, canned foods and soft drinks, and cigarette smoke. Industrial sources include insecticides, rubber tires, dyes, plastic, and solder. And now we know also that it can be found in rice at a very large amount. There are other metals in our environment, aluminum, lead, mercury, and nickel, and also airborne stressors, carbon monoxide, crop spraying, dust, electricity, exhaust fumes, fiberglass, molds, pollens, radiation, and smoke. And also waterborne chemicals, chlorine and fluoride, which we know people are fighting against, formaldehyde, and phenols. So where do we take homeopathy from here? Homeopathy can be used to help clear the effects of some of these chemical stressors, either directly or indirectly. Of course, we have to clean up the environment. That is number one, because we can't constantly be inundated with these stressors. Homeopathy is not going to be able to clear the body of something if you keep putting it back into the body. Both emotional stressors, physical stressors, mental stressors. So take yourself into a better place, into a better environment. So as I said, homeopathy is just one component of cleansing the body. We know that chelation is a very big method that people are using today to remove the heavy metals, whether they have amalgams in their teeth or vaccines in their body that have accumulated these heavy metals. You can use specific remedies to deal with the effects of the chemical stresses. For example, mixed pollens for hay fever that come on when the flowers bloom. Dusts in potency, if silica hasn't helped. A particular hair dye or perming agent or a paint or a chemical, such as formaldehyde, where a specific poison can be identified. So these I call these isopathic prescribing. They're not exactly homeopathic. Homeopathic refers to things that are similar. Isopathic refers to things that are the same. So using the same toxic that caused the problem initially. The medicine that is used in the toxin or chemical or pollen has been prepared through a dilution and a succussion method so that you will get a potency and energy of the toxin, chemical, or whatever it might be that you're allergic to or being affected by, in a way that is not going to cause any further detriment or harm to the body in any way. It is stimulating the body to recognize something that has already affected the body and will begin the body's own innate process of healing and clearing. One of the things about using the isopathic method is they have not been completely proven in the same way that homeopathic remedies have been proven. They're a little bit different. So many people are using this method, though, in sequential order very often. Okay, so now we can look at a couple of homeopathic remedies. One of them is sulfuric acid. Sulfuric acid, it helps with effects of exhaust fumes, people who are having severe headaches with ringing in the ears, constipation, persistent choking, cough, or feeling of tightness in the chest with difficulty breathing. I know sulfuric acid also has been used when you have had a surgery or where you might have used arnica for bruising or pain, but it hasn't been effective. And so this goes a little bit more deeply. The next remedy is alumina. And we know aluminum is one of the remedies in vaccines. It can be used to clear the ill effects from aluminum toxicity or even lead poisoning. Common symptoms are slowness of action, sluggishness in your behavior, dizziness, your facial continence is pale, and you have a frequent dry cough and probably frequent colds, dry, itchy skin, constipation, joint pain, and heaviness and weakness in the arms and the legs. One of the things about alumina is people, homeopaths will use it as a person who has a problem with self-identity. The next remedy is arsenicum album, one of my most favorite remedies in the homeopathic materia medica for poisoning, typically used for food poisoning when you have both diarrhea and vomiting at the same time. I've used it for salmonella poisoning or ptomaine poisoning. You have great sensitivity to chemicals, and this is also used for people who have tendencies to catch colds and coughs with sore throat. They're very anxious, restless people with exhaustion. They like frequent sips of water and lots of company and comfort. Another remedy used to clear toxicity is bromium. It is for the ill effects of dust. And if you have been in an earthquake, perhaps, earthquake vicinity, or where there's been a lot of dust thrown up into the air, perhaps a volcano, you might end up with a dry cough, worse for taking a deep breath, worse with a hoarseness and a sore throat. It's just one of the remedies to add to your list of knowledge, your knowledge base, because all of these Blog Talk Radio shows are purely educational. You must seek out your healthcare provider for any of your health needs. Cadmium sulfuricum is a fabulous homeopathic remedy, typically used for folks who have undergone radiation for cancer treatment. The ill effects of cadmium, remember that was what I began the show. Cadmium sulfuricum is a combination remedy of integrating cadmium and sulfur. And these people who might benefit have burning pains in their stomach with nausea and salty taste in the mouth, vomiting with cold sweats and sleep apnea. Their breathing absolutely stops and they wake up with startling. Their nose is chronically blocked. And you just think about any type of ill effects from radiation toxicity, and you might be thinking about this remedy, cadmium sulfuricum. Another remedy from toxicity is carbovegetabilis. It's a burnt vegetable product, and like your charcoal that you put in the grill to barbecue with, it needs oxygen in order to burn. So therefore, folks who would benefit from carbovegetabilis in homeopathic form have been exposed to carbon monoxide poisoning. They have not, they're lacking in oxygen. Both gas, coal, charcoal fumes, exhaust fumes, anything that takes away the oxygen from the blood. They end up feeling sluggish, heavy, and trembly. They're very pale, and they want to have their body fanned constantly. They're dying for fresh air. They'll open up the window. Their body might feel cold, although their head might feel hot. They feel much better for that cool air, and they have a heavy headache with nausea, with burping and dizziness and a choking cough. Another remedy used for toxicity is carbonium sulfuratum. another combo with sulfur. It's for the ill effects of gas, coal, and charcoal fumes. Again, when you think of a person who has had sort of like that carbon monoxide poisoning, you see a person who is basically unconscious. They're very dizzy, they're sleepy, they're trembling, they have cold sweats, general weakness, and a headache. They have an irritating cough, and they have difficulty focusing their eyes. So you might think about that CarboVeg and Carbonium Sulfuricum. The next remedy is Causticum. I have spoken about causticum in recent shows on Blog Talk Radio Homeopathy World Community. It was one of the major remedies I spoke about yesterday, dealing with grief, loss, disappointment. These people have a tendency to be advocates for and very passionate about some kind of campaign, one or the other. This is good for the ill effects of lead, believe it or not. So lead poisoning. They have indigestion, pain in the joints, with stiffness and general exhaustion. I also think of causticum as a person having edema in their ankles and limbs. The next remedy is chlorum. Chlorum is for ill effects of chlorine. So you can see the connection there, the isopathic connection between chlorine and chlorum. Think about people who are swimming in the swimming pool for years and years, and maybe their hair is turning green. I know that they probably reduce the amount of chlorine in pools than what they used to put in, but you can get chlorine toxicity. You can get chlorine toxicity when your local community flushes all of the pipes using chlorine, which they do one or two times a year. In that case, you might end up with catarrh, which is thick mucus in your nasal passages, a headache and an acid stomach, difficulty breathing, and feeling of constriction in your chest and your throat. I have a list of probably another 15 remedies. I know I'm not going to get to them, but I wanted to begin that list so that you would know there are many remedies available in the homeopathic Materia Medica that may assist your healing journey. I'm going to give you one more remedy today that is called Radium Bromatum for the ill effects of radiation. Another remedy that's typically used by homeopaths for people who have undergone cancer treatment and have undergone radiation, or maybe they've been exposed to radiation, for example, the Fukushima meltdown. You know, we really still have a continuing radiation leak in our environment, into our oceans, crossing the oceans, in the atmosphere, in falling down, in fallout into our soils. We are really changing our environment completely due to the exposure of these nuclear wastes. And as we, our own nuclear plants age out, and of which one here right in my neighborhood in North Carolina has shut down because of leaks, we don't have backup systems of what to do with all the waste. What are we going to do with the waste? So a little bit more knowledge for you. Radium bromatum for the ill effects of radiation, exhaustion, sleepiness, sleeps a lot but doesn't feel refreshed, headaches, aching in the back, joints and muscle pains, itchy rash, and depression. So I know it's time for me to sign out, so I'm going to do that now and let the next person come on to host the next show. Wishing everyone a fabulous week.
Across this land, both near and far, throughout the human race, within each beating heart, there is a dream whose time has come for us to claim our birthright, each and every one. have intervened, controlling from the shadows, think they can't be seen. But we have eyes, see in the dark, to cast a light upon the madness we embark. Let freedom ring throughout the land. Let no one trade your soul for dollars, dirty hands. Demand of the truth, transparency. For we must be the masters of our destiny. Upon their face, sincerity, while underneath a self-agenda does proceed. But falsity perfumes the air, the sin screams louder than the finest.